everybody. Welcome to the Dissecting Liberty podcast. Y'all thought I was already pretty low energy, but tonight I'm very low energy. Jay called me today when we released the Cotton and Derek show. He called me Valium personified, and I don't appreciate that, but I'm feeling a bit like it, so he might have had a point. How are your energy levels?
I was trying to remember what he called you, and you just reminded me. That was really accurate.
Valium. Hey. All right. So how are your energy levels, Zero?
I'm pretty mellow right now. Pretty chill.
Mellow?
Yeah.
Pretty mellow. How about you, Porter?
I'm always bouncing off the walls, dude. I don't slow down until I sleep, and sometimes I just don't sleep. I'm always ready to go.
You power through it.
No, that's not true. Ask the insurrection guys. There have been several episodes I missed because we planned them, and I just straight up fell asleep on my bedroom floor or something. And there's one, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but there's one where I fell asleep and then remembered that we were recording, and I hop in for like the last 20 minutes of the episode. But it's always on off for me. Like, I'm feeling good right now, but I mean, it's 9:30 at like 11, the light will just go out. So hopefully we can do this in under an hour and a half, because at some point I'll hit a wall, but I'm good right now.
All right. So I don't know if you remember, but this is actually the second time you've been on the podcast.
That is true. Yeah, I do remember. First time was in Auburn at Mises U.
That's right. That's right. So in case anybody hasn't listened to that, why don't you tell people who you are?
Yeah. So I'm Porter. I go by Mind Your Excuses on Instagram and Twitter. That's at Mind Your Excuses with underscores between the words on Instagram. It's all one word on Twitter. And I am a co-host of the Insurrection Inc. podcast. I'm a former writer for Cotton Report, RIP.
Pour one out.
Yeah, that's right. Dude, it was a nice project while it lasted. That's about it. I'm not too interesting, but I know my way around the Liberty sphere on Twitter.
Well, and you say you're not interesting, but you won second at Mises U, so that's pretty cool.
I did. Yeah, I don't like to bring that up because I really don't like bragging. I don't like people who brag. I don't like bragging, but and it always feels like it, even if I'm just explaining who I am. But I do like it when other people bring it up because it is cool. I am proud of it.
Oh, that was quite an achievement. And our buddy David over at the Law of Liberty won first. So.
Oh, yeah. David's awesome, dude. He's a great guy.
You know what it was?
Great podcast, too.
It is. But you know what it was? Me and Stratton are y'all's lucky charms.
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely it. Couldn't have done it without you.
That's right. Couldn't have done it without each of us having like a six pack of Miller Lite. All right. So why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about tonight?
Yeah. So I gave Zero the rundown before this. I'm going to try and be shorter than that because I was long winded. But I recently wrote a paper for my Enlightenment literature class that I'm taking for college. And it's like a seminar style class, and we just read a lot of Enlightenment texts. We also read some counter-Enlightenment texts from contemporary writers, people who lived at the same time but weren't exactly all on board with the Enlightenment. The paper was pretty open-ended for the requirements. We could write on any topic that was debated in the Enlightenment and basically apply it however we wanted, and we just had to pick some sources to explore and kind of give an exposition of and tie together for the paper. The length requirement was 7 to 8 pages. I wrote 17 because I just got really invested in this. And what I chose to write about was Enlightenment liberalism, because that's, you know, a personal passion of mine. Enlightenment liberalism was, in a lot of ways, the predecessor to modern libertarianism. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but like Mises basically drew from Enlightenment liberalism and made a whole consistent political philosophy out of it. Rothbard took from that and made what we know as anarcho-capitalism out of that by basically correcting what he saw as Mises's errors. And then Hoppe and others have developed Rothbard's theory even further. But Enlightenment liberalism was really the start for a lot of the modern libertarian movement. It's really the root of that. And so I wanted to write about that, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to write about. So I just started exploring some sources, and I quickly stumbled upon this strain of intellectual thought that I'd never been exposed to before. That was counter-enlightenment liberalism. It was mostly in the 20th century. Isaiah Berlin was the name of a guy, and I'll talk about him more later, of course, too. And he was one of these counter-enlightenment liberals. He was probably the most prominent one. And his idea was that the Enlightenment actually was what was used to justify a lot of the things that led to the failure of liberalism in the 20th century, like the Nazi and Soviet totalitarianisms and things like that, and basically disagreed with the more mainstream strain of liberal thought that saw the Enlightenment as the basis for liberalism. Berlin and this other group of intellectuals that that kind of surrounded and preceded him thought that the Enlightenment was not a good basis for liberty. It actually justified absolute despotism and stuff like that. And I had never been exposed to this. I found it really fascinating. So I wrote this paper kind of about these two competing views of the Enlightenment and of Enlightenment liberalism, and then tried to figure out if Enlightenment liberalism could be saved, could be salvaged or repaired from these really astute criticisms from the counter-Enlightenment liberals. And I didn't focus on any attacks on liberalism itself. Like all of the sources I used, all of the people I looked at were liberals in some sense, or post-liberals like Hoppe. I wrote a section in the paper on chapter 11 of Hoppe's book, Democracy: The God That Failed. And Hoppe's not a liberal; he's a libertarian anarchist. But you know, a student of Mises, student of Rothbard. And so that's kind of where I got this from, and I wanted to talk about it because I didn't realize how much was here that I'd never been exposed to, and I'm betting a lot of other people haven't been exposed to it either. And there's also a connection here to what some other people have been talking about in kind of online libertarian circles, which is postmodernism and its role in the liberty movement. Because Isaiah Berlin, I don't think he definitely didn't call himself a postmodernist, but a lot of his ideas, which we can get to, kind of lend themselves well to postmodernism, which Cotton, you know more about than I do. But it's a fascinating connection, is all I'll say for now. And that's what really got me interested in it as well, is I thought it was really applicable to other debates that are going on. But this is, you know, Berlin is a name that I'd never seen tossed out, and so I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, why don't you talk a bit more about Berlin? Because I've never heard that name before.
Yeah, so, well, actually, it might be better if I trace a small history of liberalism to really explain what Berlin was taking issue against. And so Enlightenment liberalism started with people like John Locke, Thomas Paine, Mary Wollstonecraft, these people who opposed absolute monarchy and had some idea of a natural rights philosophy. Like, by your existence, you have certain natural rights that no one can violate, no matter if they're king or what. They are absolute natural rights. And Thomas Paine especially was influential in the most successful Enlightenment liberal experiment, which was America itself. Paine wrote Common Sense, which was extremely influential in the colonies, and then you got the American Revolution. And Thomas Jefferson was another Enlightenment liberal, although he was, you know, not perfectly consistent owning slaves and stuff, which a lot of the English Enlightenment liberals were against. And so later you get kind of this development. And like I said, Mises came from these people. Mises is like the next big step in this, in my opinion, at least, next big development in liberalism. And he took out a lot of the natural rights theory, because Mises was a utilitarian, a rural utilitarian. He didn't believe in natural rights. That theory kind of died out as utilitarianism became more popular. And Mises also threw out a lot of the egalitarianism, which especially came from people like Wollstonecraft, who was one of the first feminists. And so Mises justified the whole program of liberalism based on rural utilitarian grounds as opposed to natural rights grounds, but came to pretty much the same exact political conclusions as Jefferson and Locke and other people, and was still heavily influenced by their social contract theory and things like that. And then Mises, in his book Liberalism, noted towards the end in this chapter called The Future of Liberalism, this is written in 1927, by the way, there's this great paragraph. He says, "Now our civilization is beginning to scent a whiff of death in the air. Dilettantes loudly proclaim that all civilizations, including our own, must perish. This is an inexorable law. Europe's final hour has come, warn these prophets of doom, and they find credence. An autumnal mood is perceptibly beginning to set in everywhere." So this is in 1927, and Mises clearly sees the Nazi threat on the horizon. At this point, the Soviet Union already exists in its infant stage. He clearly sees that. He senses that liberalism is about to fail, but throughout that chapter and the whole book, he really can't provide a good explanation for it. He talks a little bit about the anti-liberal mentality, but he mostly just chalks it up to envy and, you know, hatred of successful people. That's why people hate capitalism, is kind of his theory. But it's not really a satisfactory theory, in my opinion. And this is where people like Isaiah Berlin come in. Because he has, in my opinion, a much more compelling theory, even though I don't entirely agree with some of his conclusions. And I do ultimately think the Enlightenment can be salvaged, which takes some explaining, of course. But Berlin was preceded by some other thinkers, who, especially Germans, which is no surprise because one of the people that these thinkers take aim at the most is Immanuel Kant, who was also a big Enlightenment thinker in favor of democracy for somewhat egalitarian reasons as well, like Wollstonecraft was. And so some of these thinkers are like a contemporary of Kant, actually his friend, but intellectual foe, Johann Georg Hamann. That's Hamann is the last name. I'd never heard of this guy until this. It's, again, one of those people that I found interesting that I thought are useful to the libertarian movement that I'd never heard of. So Hamann says, one need not wonder for long who would be guardians of the so-called immature ones until they reach their maturity, the enlighteners themselves. Because Kant's famous definition of enlightenment was mankind's escape from its self-incurred immaturity. That's translated to English roughly, But he basically means that you're able to think for yourself. That's what enlightenment is. Once you're not guided by someone else in your thought, you're able to think for yourself and have the courage to use your own reason. That's another phrase from Kant. That's what enlightenment is, which sounds all good and well. But Hamann pointed out who are going to be the guardians of these people who can't think for themselves, the enlighteners. And then when you set up this kind of guardian class, as opposed to the immature class, and you let the guardians decide when the immature class is no longer immature, then you have this kind of enlightened despotism, which the counter-enlightenment liberals opposed. And so that's one influence on Berlin. Another one is one of the earliest classical liberals, Friedrich Heinrich Jacobi, also German, and I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but whatever. Who says, "The great mass of our thinkers want to see the essentially true and the essentially good spread by power, and want to see every error suppressed by power. They would like to help promote an enlightenment elsewhere than in the understanding, because that takes too long." And so you see these people who identify these certain strains of the Enlightenment that aren't quite as liberal as they may appear, because one of these core themes of the Enlightenment is that we can use reason, human rationalism, to organize society, and we can come up with rules to organize society that are universalistic in nature. They apply everywhere and always because they're based on reason. And some of these counter-enlightenment liberals, the key criticism of that is basically a criticism of human reason itself, like that if you get this wrong, which we tend to do because we're human and we're imperfect, then your rationalistic and universalistic schemes become things that you force onto everyone else, and you think you're freeing them, but you're actually, you know, forcing your vision onto everyone else. And this is actually, I think, a very reasonable critique, because we saw this exactly in things like the progressive movement in the United States. It's this idea that you can micromanage society, and you know, it's where eugenics came from. Eugenics in the negative sense of the word came from this idea that you can use reason to weed out all the bad ones, the people we don't want, and only preserve the good stock. And that the smart people, the intellectuals, the, you know, people in the universities and whatever should be in charge of everything else. They should control everyone else to manage society in this reasonable and intelligent way. And that's a direct result of the Enlightenment that obviously was not part of liberal thought, because liberals oppose that kind of micromanagement. Even Mises, of course, even though he was basically an Enlightenment liberal, even though he modified some of their theories, he still believed in this universalistic approach that we could always, that we could use science, in his case, the science of economics, to rationally organize society. That's very much an Enlightenment belief. And that same Enlightenment belief, though, is exactly what was used to justify things like the progressive movement. And even worse, it was used to justify, to some extent, the totalitarianism of the 20th century. This idea that if you have the right idea of a rationalistic and universalistic scheme for society, that then you should move society towards that, whether individuals want to or not, because if they don't want to, then they're just not enlightened, and they deserve to be controlled by the guardian class in Haman's terms. And that was basically the idea behind the Nazi regime and even the Soviet regime, that you can push society in this one direction. It's, you know, a form of collectivism, actually, collectivist thinking, one of the worst forms of collectivist thinking. And this is what the counter-Enlightenment liberals identified. And so that's who influenced Berlin. Now we're finally getting to Berlin.
But before we do that,
sure.
Let me mention something I took away from what you said before. You were talking about like Wollstonecraft's egalitarianism. Do you think like a clear lineage behind that and Twitter whores posting pictures of their tits on the website? Do you think that can be that connection can be made?
Yes, absolutely. The only thing Wollstonecraft ever did well was give birth to Mary Shelley, and it was a much better writer.
That's right, man.
Actually, she didn't even do that well. It killed her. Wollstonecraft died in childbirth when she had Mary Shelley. Dude. I'm a terrible person, but yeah, you're right. That's on. I think there is a direct connection there.
Man.
And that's another thing. You can see how the Enlightenment has some problems with it as a basis for liberalism when you look at some of the justifications, like why Mises had to modify some parts of the Enlightenment to make it fit into his more consistent liberal program. Like we know now from superior intellectuals, superior thinkers, that egalitarianism is completely at odds with liberty. And so to see that as a key aspect of some of these Enlightenment thinkers' thoughts, you know, or you can see how it lends itself to anti-liberty philosophies. But anyway, now we're getting to Berlin, and so those people, Haman and Jacobi, were some of his influences. Berlin was Latvian born, but he lived in Britain most of his life, so he was a British social and political philosopher. And he took this kind of a step further, made it more philosophical, identified these criticisms, and really developed a consistent theory out of them. And to summarize, there's a great quote from him, quoted in this article by Graeme Gerard. And Berlin says, "Many of the political disasters of the last two centuries, beginning with the Reign of Terror, originate in this Enlightenment project to unbend, quote, the crooked timber of humanity, to make it conform to a single ideal, to bring the many into a coherent, systematic unity, by laws and education, if possible, by force, if necessary," end quote. And so that's exactly what Berlin's philosophy is getting at. And his argument for liberalism was based on pluralism instead of this Enlightenment rationalism, this idea that through science and reason we can organize society in this perfectly rational and almost systematic way. Like he says, a coherent systematic unity, as Berlin described the view. For Berlin, the best argument for liberalism is based on an affirmation of cultural diversity and a rejection of the belief in the singularity of truth. That's a quote from Gerard in the article. Or maybe it's Gerard. I don't know. I don't know how to pronounce it. But and so this is where you see like a connection between Berlin and postmodernism, this rejection of the belief in the singularity of truth. As far as I know, that's a connection. Like I said, I'm not quite as well read on postmodernism as I'd like to be.
I'm just watching Liberty Zero like eat gum or something. What are you eating over there? I gotta know.
He's chowing down. Yeah,
it's Laffy Taffy.
He's eating Laffy Taffy right now. He's not taking this serious.
I'm listening. Taffy. What?
Dude, I'm just rambling. He can eat as much Laffy Taffy as he wants.
That's right. I can multitask here.
How many Laffy Taffys can you fit in your mouth at one time?
Well, I don't have enough Laffy Taffys sitting around to do that.
Man. I'm questioning your commitment. I don't know what to say. All right, I'm sorry.
You interrupted Porter.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I can hardly take this seriously now. and of course, Berlin, it's important to note, I don't know the exact year he was born. I should have looked that up before we started recording. But I do know he died in 1997, and he lived to 80 or 90 years old, I think. So, I mean, his life was the 20th century. He saw this. He grew up in, you know, the golden years of liberalism, like I said, the end of the golden years, kind of this waning phase where they were already kind of fading out leading up to World War One, because the golden age, as Mises described it, at least, was between 1848, the revolutions of 1848, and World War One. That was when liberalism took its strongest hold in Europe. And Mises himself says this in Liberalism, says it never took full hold, like the whole program of liberalism never quite succeeded, but this was the closest it ever came. And so Berlin grew up at the very end of that, like when he was a child was the very end of that period. And then he sees the whole 20th century stretched out in front of him. And so he has a very acute perspective, I think, on the failure of liberalism. He's, you know, in the perfect historical place to observe this. And that's why I think he deserves a hearing out. And his view is obviously in direct contradiction to the Enlightenment liberals, because they believe that this standard of universal rationalism was the best defense of a free society, because they used it to oppose absolute monarchy, which of course Hoppe contradicts later, and used it to justify natural rights theory and all kinds of things like that, which in terms of the actual political program, Berlin agreed with, but the foundations were wrong, according to him. And like he says, the great 18th century philosophers were ultimately responsible for a lot of intellectual tyranny, ending in the Soviet Union, the Gulag. That's a quote from Berlin as well. And so he blames these Enlightenment philosophers for the 20th century that he lived through. But then I think we can kind of modify this. This is where I went in the paper I wrote.
Before we do that,
yeah.
I have his Wikipedia page pulled up, and it's interesting because, like, for different thinkers and their Wikipedia pages, they have this interesting thing at the bottom that shows their influences and then people they influenced. I don't know how they tally that, but it's always, in my experience, pretty accurate and interesting. You know, you find a lot of gold in that little section. And I'm looking at his influences, and it's a lot of, like, typical influences of people that wrote in the 20th century. like Sigmund Freud jumps out, Charles Darwin. Mm-hmm. Let's see, I see Haman, and then Karl Marx, John Stuart Mill, Friedrich Nietzsche, Tolstoy, Ludwig Wittgenstein. I know I did not pronounce that right, even though I know the guy.
Yeah, close enough.
But then I look at his people that he influenced, and I don't see any postmodernists. So I think that's interesting. The only name other than John Gray that sticks out to me, I don't know who that is, but that name rings a bell. But then
I know that name as well. I'm trying to figure out where I know that name from.
But the only name I outright recognize is John Rawls.
Which is interesting. Yeah, that's very fascinating.
And they say he's of the analytic school, which is, like, based off what you've said so far, like, he sounds a bit postmodern, but, like, analytic philosophy is very, like, the exact right. opposite. So that's interesting. I don't really have anything to say about it, but
Well, I will say that this article by Graeme Gerard that I read, and Gerard, or Gerard, however you pronounce it, is basically like the authority figure on Berlin.
Zer.
Yeah, that. it's a libertarian redhead on Twitter. Is a professor.
What's her OnlyFans?
Yeah, it's a professor of politics at Cardiff University, and she's basically the authority on Berlin. I really hope it's a woman. I called her she now. It's okay. There's no universal truth about his, her gender.
That's right.
And in that article, she says, I'll just use she. I'm going to get hung up on this. In that article, she says that there's kind of a debate between the postmodernists and the anti-postmodernists. Like, there's not any defined school opposing them, but basically some of the postmodernists try to claim Berlin as their own, and then some other political philosophers and intellectuals say no, he wasn't a postmodernist. And that the article I read didn't go into these details, so I don't really have a strong opinion. I just see how his view could lend itself very strongly to postmodernism. So I am surprised that there aren't more postmodernists on that list that you found.
One more thing, and then we can move on. Like, sure. I know a big postmodern thinker right now. I mean, he's dead, but he's his ideas are really influential right now, is Gil Deleuze. Like, mm-hmm. Burge talked a lot about him. And there are some people that say he was a liberal. So it's all this stuff is fairly arbitrary. It's not clear. There aren't any clear distinctions.
And to be fair, I actually don't know if Berlin's specific political beliefs. Like, I imagine he probably wasn't quite as extreme as Mises. I mean, Mises was very fiery in his defense of free markets and private property a lot of the time. Berlin was probably a bit more mainstream in terms of his political beliefs, I would imagine. Yeah. Probably more similar to Hayek. But I know he believed in basically limited government. He was a believer in representative democracy, which was standard for liberals of his time, including Mises, of course. It's interesting, actually, in the 1967, I think it was, preface to liberalism, Mises actually doubles down on his defense of democracy, which I thought was interesting. You can find this on the Mises Institute's website. You can read his preface when the book was republished at that time. And he calls democracy basically the... I'm not using the right word, like the corollary to the market system. Like, democracy is to politics what the free market is to economics, is basically what he says, which is really fascinating because, of course, Hoppe comes along much later, 40 years later, and completely contradicts that, which I still think is probably Hoppe's most important contribution, is his evisceration of democracy.
Yeah.
Anyway, I should get back on track with Berlin. So Berlin takes this view that that universal rationalism, which is this big theme of the Enlightenment, and that's what the Enlightenment liberals use to justify their beliefs. Berlin says that is actually the greatest threat to to a free society, because it, when people in power adopt that mindset or that idea, that philosophy, that leads them to impose it or believe they can impose it on other people. But this is in opposition to Mises and a lot of the other Enlightenment liberals, because they believed that they had discovered the truth through the use of reason and science, and that the reason and science absolutely opposed any government intervention and any form of despotism or absolute government at all. And so you have these two very separate approaches coming to the same political conclusion. And, of course, Berlin blames the failure of liberalism in the 20th century on its basis in the Enlightenment, because he says the Enlightenment is the basis for totalitarianism as well. And so it's not a good foundation for liberty, and that's why it failed. And Mises never comes up with a satisfactory explanation that's internally consistent. Berlin does. So that's why I think he's worth listening to. And now, how I interpret this and how I think we can kind of modify Enlightenment liberalism to avoid the criticisms of Berlin, but take the best parts of Mises and the other Enlightenment liberals, starts with Hoppe. And I'm going to skim over this really quickly because it's not that important. But Hoppe provides basically just an alternative view of the 20th century and the failure of liberalism and the rise of social democracy after World War II. And he offers a different view. Hoppe, for his part, is an Enlightenment liberal, basically, without the egalitarianism and the democracy. He very much is otherwise a believer in Enlightenment themes. Hoppe emphasizes reason and rationalism and economic science throughout all of his work. And so he's definitely opposed to Berlin's view. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But Hoppe basically offers this other explanation that says liberalism failed because it wasn't internally consistent. They always, the earliest ones, John Locke especially, and everyone since him, believed in limited government, which he says not only wasn't necessary to protect what they saw as natural rights, you know, the right to property, free association, contract, all the things that the Enlightenment liberals believed in, but he says it's actually detrimental to those beliefs for reasons that all of us know, obviously, because we're anarchists who are well acquainted with this stuff. You can't have a property-protecting property expropriator. That's what the state is. Through taxation, it violates property rights. And then its only job, according to the Enlightenment liberals, is to protect private property rights. So that's clearly a contradiction. And Hoppe says liberalism failed because it essentially wasn't true. It held this internal contradiction that's not resolvable. And so you have to be an anarchist to be consistent liberal. Consistent libertarian is what we'd call it now, obviously. And so that's, I only mentioned that to offer a different view, something separate from Isaiah Berlin, because right now it seems like he has a pretty compelling explanation for why liberalism failed and the philosophical basis behind totalitarianism. But now we get to how I think we can kind of modify it, and this draws heavily from Stephen Horwitz, who's an Austrian school economist. I don't know where he taught, maybe Ball State, I think, but I'm not sure if he's still there. I don't know. He's taught at different places, I think. But anyway, he wrote this article a few years ago called From Smith to Menger to Hayek. And Horwitz is a Hayekian, I should mention. He's not quite as radical as Mises. Yeah, boo, but it's a good article. And he takes this view. He's basically doing the same thing I'm trying to do, which is salvage Enlightenment liberalism from the counter-Enlightenment liberals. And he says the problem with this view of the Enlightenment is that it's not a complete view of the Enlightenment. So basically, Berlin's criticisms were on point about a certain part of the Enlightenment, but there was this whole other category because it wasn't a monolithic movement. It never was. And that's part of the problem with the way modern literary scholars view it, is too often it's the Enlightenment instead of the English Enlightenment, the German Enlightenment, and what I'm going to talk about, the Scottish Enlightenment. And the Scottish Enlightenment is Adam Smith and David Hume and a few other more minor characters. And these guys took a very different view, although they share some of the main themes of the Enlightenment, which is why they're obviously still considered part of it. And so what Adam Smith thought, this is, I mean, he's the biggest contributor to the Scottish Enlightenment, although Hume was pretty influential as well. Adam Smith recognized, of course, the invisible hand. That's his key contribution, or one of his key contributions, I should say. That's what Horowitz identifies here. It's this idea that humans act on reason as in self-interest. So Adam Smith basically connects reason to self-interest. And so we can recognize that, one, we're better off when we exchange with other people. We're better off by social interaction with other people. And that's a faculty of reason. And two, we don't exist. We don't make our living by just charity. We don't just beg other people. We convince them that they stand to benefit from exchanging with us. And we stand to benefit from exchanging with them. We already know that because it's in our self-interest, but then we convince other people that it's in their self-interest to engage with us as well. And Smith says that's basically a form of argument. To convince someone to trade with you is basically a form of argument, even if you don't do any verbal arguing. To convince someone to engage with you out of their own self-interest is basically a faculty of reason. And so you still have this Enlightenment theme of reason and human rationalism without taking this extremely universalistic view. It's like an individualistic view of it. And then Horowitz says the next step in this process is Minger. He expands this and says that we, through these exchanges and this essentially decentralized use of reason and all these individual interactions that happen millions of times, everywhere across the world each day, we get natural social institutions that arise out of human action but not human design. And Minger's famous example is money, how you get a standard money. It's not imposed. It's not not just standardized by an outside force or a top-down force like the state. It arises out of all these people acting in their self-interest, and you can... There, I'm not going to explain Minger's whole process here of how money arrives in the market, how you get a generally accepted, whatever you want to call it. My mind is blanking. Yeah, generally accepted medium of exchange. That's the word I was thinking of. Hitting the wall. I'm getting tired. And so that's the next step, is that we get these social institutions that are an outgrowth of the individual use of reason, but they're not imposed by the guardian class, as Saman described it, something like that. They're not imposed from the top down. They're still the result of reason, though, but it's more on an individual sense, not a universalistic one. And then the last step, Horowitz argues it's Hayek. I would say you could just as easily put Mises here, or even Rothbard. Rothbard's really the most consistent one, I think, in this regard. But all three of them are in the same tradition. It's the same point. But Hayek maybe is the best one here because his work specifically focused so much on the use of knowledge in society. In fact, I think that might actually be one of the names of his books. But Hayek talks about the social use of knowledge, and this is what Horowitz identifies. And Hayek says that all these exchanges in the market process use dispersed knowledge and basically fragmented pieces of knowledge. You know, the price system carries knowledge about the scarcity of certain resources and items and stuff, but you don't necessarily have to know, or you maybe can't even know, why something's price is this or why something is priced more or less than something else. These are all just tiny bits of knowledge that are extremely contextual and impossible to centralize. That's part of Hayek's argument, is that you can't just take up all this knowledge, you can't summarize it, and then have one central ruler, central controller use it all to organize society rationally. It only happens on the individual level because these bits of knowledge are so contextual and fragmented, and sometimes maybe even contradictory to each other. But we organize it through this individual action in self-interest, which is a faculty of reason, as Adam Smith proved, or at least argued. And this is where it gets kind of interesting, because Hayek actually starts to sound similar to Berlin. And let me find the quote. I meant to have it highlighted, but I don't. So Hayek, his idea of this this decentralized use of reason, and that that information is fragmented and often contradictory, and people basically have their own individual truths, and that starts to sound similar to Berlin, saying there's no one truth, no one single monistic way to organize society. That's basically the same thing as what Hayek is saying about knowledge. And so you kind of see, because Horowitz draws this straight line between the Scottish Enlightenment and 20th century liberalism in the form of Hayek, who was himself a student of Mises, and so in the exact same line of thought. And so with this line drawn between that part of the Enlightenment and Hayek, and then we make this connection between Hayek and Berlin, how they kind of start to sound the same. Not quite the same philosophical foundation, but they do start to have some similarities that you can identify in how they talk about knowledge and the use of reason in society to use that knowledge to make ourselves better off, which is the goal of the program of liberalism. Then you actually kind of see like a similarity between the Scottish Enlightenment and Berlin. Not quite the same thing. Again, Berlin was definitely not part of the Enlightenment. He was counter-Enlightenment. But there's a way to kind of reconcile these two strains of thought, I think. And that's how we can take account of Berlin's criticism of Enlightenment without totally accepting this idea that there's no objective truth, there's no singular truth, because I'm not sure I'm ready to accept that. And maybe if I read more on postmodernism and became convinced, maybe I would. But right now, I think Berlin's theory lends itself a little bit too much to moral relativism, and I don't entirely reject this idea of a singular objective truth. I think his criticism is valid, and that no one can prove that they know this one singular objective truth conclusively, at least not conclusively enough to justify them being an authoritarian ruler who directs the rest of society basically through an enlightened despotism. I think that idea is faulty, and that's what Berlin's criticism best applies to. But using this contribution of Hayek and his use of knowledge in society, you can still have a reliance on reason and human rationalism and a belief in objective truth that doesn't automatically lend itself to that kind of despotism. And that's where you can save the Enlightenment, I think. You can save Enlightenment liberalism if you look at it like that. But too often, liberals like Mises and even Hoppe don't look at it that way. They still, it's the use of science and reason to rationally organize society in this perfect way. And I think when you slip into that mindset is when Berlin's criticisms become applicable. And so we should be careful when explaining our libertarian philosophy, the outgrowth of liberalism. We should not slip into this into that mindset where we can rationally organize society, because that's what lends itself to despotism.
Yeah.
I just repeated myself like 10 times, but I hope I made sense.
No, I was gonna I was gonna have you like kind of summarize your thoughts at the end, but you did it yourself, so
yeah.
I hate that.
I think I did it in the most long-winded way possible. I trying not to quote verbatim from my paper, but
man, yeah, that's really interesting. And after we record, or after we finish recording, I got a lot of stuff to look up, but I'm too low energy, and that's a lot of information.
Yeah, that was heavy. That was a lot I think I just talked for like 20 minutes straight, just ranting.
No, I think that's cool. Like, I think it's interesting because definitely considering that people like Keynes and Marx came from liberal traditions, I think that you have to talk about, and Enlightenment traditions, I think you definitely have to talk about the shortcomings of both.
Right, yeah, that's a really good point. Like, Marx was basically an Enlightenment philosopher. I mean, he was a believer in scientific socialism. That's what he set out to do. He hated the utopian socialists of, like, the French tradition. He set out to prove socialism scientifically, essentially. Or at least prove that capitalism was unethical or whatever, or unworkable. And that it was basically kind of this Enlightenment view that you could prove rationally that capitalism couldn't work and socialism was the only way. And yeah, he's very much, I think, in my opinion at least, he's an Enlightenment philosopher. And so you can see how Berlin's criticism is very acute because of that.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, nowadays you just keep hearing, you know, listen to the science, and there are all these people that genuinely believe that they are on the side of science, quote unquote, when they're clearly not. So I think that anything relating to that definitely is worth talking about and worth dissecting a bit. So yeah, I think it's interesting. Are you going to write anything about this that you're going to publish anywhere?
I haven't decided yet. I think I'd like to, once I can kind of make my thoughts more concise. Podcast form is the best I can get it right now. But yeah, if I can make it more concise, or just find a way where I can publish my English paper that I wrote, because that's pretty good. That might be as good as it gets. If I can find somewhere that I'll publish that, then that would work too. But yeah, I mean, maybe I'll try writing something for Mises.org again. That would be cool. Have a second article up there. I definitely have to obviously make it much more concise. I have to write on one small part of it, but Ryan McMacken might like that. That'd be cool.
Yeah, well, unless you have anything to say, Zero, I think that's a good stopping point.
Yeah, this is one of those episodes I'm going to have to re-listen to. You did a good job making it clear, but like you said, it's pretty heavy and pretty dense.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I'm not sure I actually did a good job of making it clear to listen to, but thank you for at least saying I did.
I understood. So one more time, why don't you go ahead and tell everybody where they can find you and any other plugs?
Yeah, so first of all, Insurrection Inc. podcast, that's available on any podcast platform that basically normal people listen to. I think Jay stopped uploading to a few, but anything the Anchor goes to, Apple, Spotify. We're also on YouTube. I think Jay's still uploading episodes to there. So you can find Insurrection Inc. anywhere.
That guy. I don't know about him.
You can find Insurrection Inc. basically anywhere. That's just INC Inc. And then my profiles are at Mind Your Excuses, all one word on Twitter, and underscores between the words on Instagram. Don't really post on Instagram anymore, but I do post funny things on my story, at least. Like, I'm a meme curator at this point, but you can find me there as well if you're on Instagram. It's a good time. And yeah, that's about it. That's all I've got. Oh, actually, one more thing. I've started making videos again. If you're into video games, especially Far Cry, I have a YouTube channel called Stone Age Productions. I just decided to start doing that again. Totally not politics related at all. Not going to be connected to anything I do in politics, but if by chance anyone who listens is interested in gaming, I'm making videos on there again, just as kind of an outlet to get away from politics a lot of the time. But yeah, got that as well.
All right. Zero, we haven't done it in a while, but do you want to go ahead and do the outro? It's
been a minute. Yeah, so I'm Liberty Zero, reminding you to zero your rifle.
And I'm Cotton Arcist, reminding you to pick cotton voluntarily.